Hello, and welcome to AMO Kenzoku, episode 53. We are a group of four bubblegum crisis boomer otaku who wanted an excuse to talk about anime, manga, and any subjects we find interesting. The Kenzoku are...
Hi, all. I'm Mike.
Hello, I'm Nick.
I'm Sam.
And I am your host tonight, Dylan. This episode's being recorded on 30 May 2024, and today we'll be discussing Pat Labor the Movie, or also known as P1, or Egabon Pat Labor, Kido Keisatsu Pat Labor. So with that, I say Hashin! So, Pat Labor is a franchise that I have been a huge fan of for pretty much from the first time I saw anything for it. I think I was kind of sold. I honestly don't remember what it was that I saw first for Pat Labor. I don't know if it was movie one or if it was the first OVA. I don't think it was TV I saw first, but it may have been movie one.
It was movie one for me, for sure.
Likewise. Okay.
I'm embarrassed to admit it was probably Wasted 13 for me.
What? Really? No way.
Wow, that's wild.
When, interesting.
I think, did y'all show that in club as an After Hours or something?
Like in 2002? Probably. I want to say. Maybe 2001?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
That feels right.
So the movie, directed by Mamoru Oshii, screenplay by Kazunori Ito, based on a kind of story by Masami Yuki. And credited creator is Headgear, which is the group of Ito, Yuki, Oshii, character designer, Akemi Takada, mechanical designer,
Izabuchi
Yutaka. Which every single one of those people has done so many things of incredible talent, where you could take Pat Labor out of their credits and you'd still be like, oh man, this person might be like a top 25 creator for things. It was how crazy that is.
Definitely. Dream team.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that Headgear was very much kind of an anime supergroup.
Yeah. The movie was released theatrically on July 15th, 1989. In Japan, I don't really have theatrical numbers there. Kind of interest is that 2 weeks later, or July 29th, is when Kiki's Delivery Service was released to theaters. So that was a nice summer. Ooh. With because Kiki's was with Grave of the Fireflies as well. So that's a nice summer triple treat there.
No, Totoro or, was or, with Grave. Of
oh,
the
Totoro,
Fireflies
Grave of the. That's right.
Earlier.
That's right. The highest and the lowest. That's right.
Yeah, that was 88, I believe.
That was 88. Okay, yeah. That's right. That's right. You had Grave of the Fireflies, Totoro, and Akira, and Char's Counterattack. That's right. So in summer of 89, all you got was Pat Labor Movie 1 and Kiki's Delivery Service, which, yeah.
It's like the TV series was airing at the same time.
I believe OVA predates it.
So OVA came out before the movie did.
It was 88 is what I have on my, for one of our first episodes, I made a timeline, and assuming it's correct, I have early days in 88, April 88, TV in October 89.
What I'm seeing is Pat Labor, the TV series, 1989 to 1990, 47 yeah. episodes, and Pat Labor, the new files, which I believe is the second OVA.
Yeah, it's the second OVA.
Was out in 1992. I actually don't see OVA. Oh, early days OVA, 88 to 89, 7 episodes.
Yeah. And the after the OVAs were kind of an interesting thing, and we don't want to get too much. I don't want to get too crazy on there because there's so much in this movie, but they did release kind of a preview thing for the movie titled Pat Labor episode 7.5, because the first OVA series ran 7 episodes, so it did come out after that, but obviously production began whilst they were in the middle of it. I have many copies of this movie and so much extra material. It's it's crazy, and it's because everyone's the title, whatever opinion. I'll debate anything. I don't care. You can't affect my opinion. Like, I love this movie. Like, just, I think it is so fabulous. Like, I have like 8 or 10 different copies of this movie.
Wow.
Like, in every single different format possible, from original VHS through Laserdisc, like 4 or 5 different copies on, maybe 6 copies on DVD, then like 2 or 3 copies on Blu-ray, plus supplemental discs and things. And so I want to talk a little bit kind of about where it came from time, because I was reading a little bit in some of the booklets and stuff I have today, which I should have gone before, where it kind
Wait,
of started
before you,
up.
Before you go, yeah, go get ahead. Too far, I did want to comment yeah. On the topic of media.
Yeah.
I realized I don't own the Blu-rays of this movie.
Oh, interesting.
Did you watch the Animes DVD?
Sorry, what?
Did you watch the Animes DVD then?
Yes, I did. I was going through my... Because what I was going to do is, as it happened for a lot of these episodes that we've done, my collection of physical media is mostly in the back of this closet that's just filled with junk, and I've not wanted to go back there and find stuff because there's lots of boxes. And so I figured, oh, I'll rent it online. Like, that's no big deal. I couldn't find it. It wasn't on the Apple TV, so I kind of gave up. And so I went digging through my stuff, and I found the old manga DVD, the original one,
mm-hmm.
and the Onyami's one, which I have never ever watched. I've watched the original the manga one probably a few times, but that's what I watched on was the Onyami's one. I was so crushed that I didn't have it on Blu-ray, so I got to go buy and remedy that.
Yeah, if you can get it, I still think it's out. It's a bargain. That's why
yeah,
I bought
the full
two
collection
copies of,
is
yeah,
like
the complete collection of Pat LaBour. It's a made in Japan thing. It's like $50 or something. It's literally
everything.
Everything.
It's everything.
Actually, I'm not. Does it have Mini Pato on there?
I actually haven't checked if it has Mini Pato, but it has every feature length movie, every OVA on it.
It's like I found all those. I have the Blu-rays for all of the other stuff, just not
of course,
the movies.
Yes, yes, of course it knows. That's as with anything that's mildly older, it can be sometimes hit or miss for streaming. And it's weird that parts of it are up streaming, and that the TV series is up on High Dive, but the rest of it is not, which is frustrating, and it's not in CR. I'm glad you didn't watch the manga version, because that was actually a non-anamorphic DVD version. So
yikes.
one of those things we had to remember about back in the day, where they encoded it as like a
the black bars
for a 4:3 TV to make it look like it was widescreen. Back in those days, we're like, oh man, look, they actually encoded anamorphic. Holy crap.
The Onyami's DVD, actually, I was pretty impressed with how it looked. I don't really have any complaints. HD would have been nice, but for DVD, it's really good.
Yeah, I'm sure it went off the good copy. And I was looking through the additional booklet in there. It's very nice. It's super dense. They collected a bunch of different interview things and translated stuff. So it's a dense book. It's like, I didn't read through all of it. It's almost 200 pages of like nice printing, translated everything of a bunch of stuff from the different archives. So it's definitely a cool thing to have. The extra DVD on there is a half hour. It's that 7.5 thing. It's cool to watch. It's just a half hour video that talks about some of the production stuff for the movie.
I'll have to check that out.
And you get to see all of the creators, because it was done, I think, basically before the movie came out or right after it did or something. So you get to see all the creators in Tokyo in 1989.
Oh wow!
So they look shockingly, they all look a little bit younger. As a picture of us would also look a bit younger. So in reading, looking through some of that stuff, kind of the Pat Labor came out really from, it was an idea that Masami Yuki had. He was the manga, the author of the manga for it. And it took about five, it kind of started actually some sketches and ideas and stuff back in like 1983. With Masami Yuki, he was completely unknown at that time. And I think even then he and, Izubuchi started kind of working together and playing around with some ideas. And then he had Masami Yuki had a fairly popular manga, which got him a little bit of stuff. And then I think as well, just the rest of the people working, and for whatever reasons, they all got together to work on the various Pat Labor products. So particularly with the movie, it ends up, Pat Labor is this very interesting thing where it's the same creative team, but you have the original OVA, like designs and look and aesthetic and timeline. And then you have the movies, which have a completely different kind of design aesthetic look to them. And then you have the TV show, which has another completely different design aesthetic and a different timeline as well. And then the manga.
They all have quite different tones.
Yeah, and they all have very different tones. In trying to focus on the movie and some things that it did that I think are really cool and interesting, is one is that this was the start of, this movie was the start of even more people's careers and things, like the character designer, animation director, Kazuchika Kise, who's all the Ghost in the Shell designs and so many other things. This was, I think, one of his like first things. He was like 23. At the time. And they're like, yeah, you're in charge of this. Go ahead. You got it. You know, and you could say, well, obviously they made the right choice there. No. No problems. Same with like ING Tatsunoko, where you see the credit as the animation, because that was, this was the first production when, what would later become Production IG before they even had that name. Where they were the animation production team with a lot of support from Studio Dean, because they were such a small studio at the time. So when you see that, it's the same ING that is Production IG. I forget their names right now.
Mitsushima Ishikawa and Tatsuyuki Goto.
Yep. That is the IG of Production IG. So,
which they are one of the few. Like, anime studios just come and go throughout the years, and these guys are one of the few that have just rose up to the top and have stayed at the top.
Stayed resilient
the whole time.
I mean, yeah, they just launched the Haikyuu movie, so
yeah,
oh yeah, that's
right. They're going
strong. Yeah. So as far as the plot of the movie, it's fabulous. You know, it starts off with a smirk and a suicide. And then a robot out of control, and then we get into
trying to
figure out why. Yep.
Before we get into the plot, can we also, because Pat Labor's timeline is definitely not one of the clearest things, can we kind of set like basis for where at least each of us feel the movie should be if you wanted to watch things chronologically? Because my understanding and my recollection is that you need to watch, well, not need, but in order to be introduced to the characters as they are in the movie, you should watch OVA 1 first.
Well, it's a thing where it's kind of interesting because
the characters definitely are not introduced in the movie. The movie portrays the characters as if the audience is familiar with them. That's for certain.
I agree with that. And I always kind of thought that, maybe it is different that I don't actually know if, I think you're correct in that the early days OVA is supposed to be, I think that's actually is in the same timeline as the movies.
Because the early days OVA, I believe, is basically the formation of SV2, and you see everybody you see the band get together, you know, so to speak. You see their hijinks in other, you know, things like TV and OVA 2, but I think the formation of SV2 as we see it in the movie is most definitely in OVA 1. Is that correct?
Yeah. And TV is a separate timeline.
Right.
I mean, I would say that you definitely get more out of the movie if you've seen that first, but it's mm-hmm. it's also kind of like you can watch the movie on its own and it's still really good. Like, I mean,
I don't disagree, but I would say that I feel like it's a bit more of an enriching experience if you've watched the OVA and you know these characters first and you understand like the context of, like, for example, when, you know, not to jump too far, but like when Shiga and Kanoka come back into play, like you understand mm-hmm. like the weight True. Of those characters. That being said, I do agree. I think the movie stands very well on its own because it's been quite a bit since I've watched anything Pat Labor, and this movie 100% holds up on its own for sure. That I do want to clarify that. But yeah anyway, I think I just wanted to make sure we got that cleared up. But yeah, sorry, Dylan. So, you know,
no, fine.
We have the snarky suicide.
Yeah, snarky suicide, then a robo that's gone crazy and has no one in the driver's seat. And then we get into more labors going berserk. Lots of investigation follows. They figure out that it's a deeply nested computer virus. And the team figures out the only way to stop the labors from completely destroying Tokyo is to take out the Ark, which is a main piece of their Babylon project, which is to recover a whole bunch of land out of the Tokyo Bay. And they go and they try and do that and stop, and they do because a hurricane approaches, a literal hurricane, Konya hurricane, that will set off everything. And they go out there and destroy the Ark. But they save the rest of Tokyo on some pretty shaky evidence.
Well, it's a good summary.
And that's one of those things where, like, that doesn't tell you anything about the movie other than, oh, okay, it has beginning, a middle, and an end. Okay.
One of the things that struck me watching this movie was, although with anything sci-fi, right, they're making kind of guesses at the future, and Pat Labor in particular is kind of an alternate history almost. But this, like, as a person who works in technology, like, I can be sensitive to the way that some of this stuff is portrayed in kind of technobabble and things like that. When it's things that are kind of real, it's realistic. And they did a pretty good job, I think, with the whole virus thing. Like, all of that stuff can be real. Like, these are things we kind of worry about today, like persistent viruses. Like, oh, you can't just uninstall the software necessarily and it be gone, right? Like, I thought that was nice. And then if anybody's been following the tech news very closely, some of the deeper stuff, there's been like recent backdoors that have been found that have, like, so, like, you think about, like, well, how could they possibly have this thing when it detects this frequency? Like, then things, it triggers something to go berserk. Well, like, we've got kind of real world examples, not quite the same, but it's realistic enough that, like, you're not taken out of things if you're someone familiar with this industry.
Yeah, and especially given that this was released in July of 1989, so it was conceptualized, I think, back in like 87, and then kind of production was like 88 and so. So, you know, even watching that the video that was made in 89 about it, and they're literally on there talking, and like the screenwriter Kazunori Ito, he's like, yeah, you know, I've got my word processor, and like these computers and things are tools that are actually kind of becoming like useful for doing my job.
Mm.
So, you know, and like there was some like coordination of stuff about the screenplay that they say was like, and like some of the works and stuff that was done over BBSs.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so like this is one of the things about, I think, Pat Labor at large, and particularly in this movie, is that, yeah, even watching it now, where the movie was made in 89, Pat Labor is supposed to be set in 1999, so 10 years in the future, as kind of like, okay, it's one of those things where it's a good thing where it's like, all right, it's a near enough future where you could be like, all right, yeah, what if we had some slightly different technological change or breakthrough that caused this,
mm-hmm.
The labor, you know, the labor craziness that everyone gets on the AI labor train.
Which I will say that some of the same fears around AI, and although this is a perennial fear with, you know, it's been around for a long time, but
yeah,
kind of like the laborers are taking the jobs of, you know, it takes whatever, one laborer can do the job of 10 men or something like that, they say in the movie. Like,
yeah,
this was a concern that they had, but the gains were just too big, and so...
But it's, I think it's even more impressive, yeah, that, you know, it was supposed to be set in 99, and now that's, 99 is way long, 25 years in the past. And that even with that, you can still watch it and it doesn't feel like many other things. You're like, oh man, this is just like weird comical technology. Like, sure, some things there's printouts and stuff like that, but even with that, like, you could totally, it was not immersion breaking. And it also, at least to me, didn't feel like it was anything that wasn't plausible. Yeah, particularly the stuff of saying like, oh yeah, well, we just tried to reinstall the old operating system. What'd it do? Oh, well, you just nailed the thing deeper inside of there and installed it on everything now. Great.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as somebody who's, you know, not like who's a tech enthusiast, but far from like a deep technical expert, the part I particularly found really interesting was when they're running the simulation in Asuma and Shiga running that simulation in Shiga's, you know, sweaty, you know, room. You know, they're hitting the wall, and then they have, you know, Asuma has the epiphany of the resonance, and he tells Shiga, you know, try it running in these parameters using the arc. He's like, well, this is going to take more horsepower. So he like networks into the SV2's headquarters, like, you know, computer systems to get more processing power. I'm like, that's super believable, because if you're running some sort of really high end, like especially like 3D simulation, when you're involving something like the Arc, and you know, you're trying to run this sort of simulation, I would imagine it takes quite a lot of processing power. So that was super interesting that they opted to go that route, and you know, kind of helps build the tension for like the outcome there when you see the result, and you know, it's the whole screen just goes red, right? So
yeah.
It's like that's like the holy crap moment, and I thought that was really well. I mean, that's just one of what I can say hundreds of things about this movie that just absolutely enamored me. I mean, from a technical standpoint of executing this movie, it's so unbelievable how much detail is in basically every single cut of this movie.
Yeah.
One thing that I noted early was when the first labor was rampaging in the city, and SV2 is deployed to, you know, stop it, and there's that scene where everybody's evacuating, and so, you know, in all those, in most anime and even movies, right, when there's mass hubbub and there's, you know, a big scene of a lot of moving people, like, going, kind of, you know, moving in this, you know, uniform direction, at some point, if the scene goes on for more than a handful of seconds, you see an animation loop, right? Like, it's I spot checked that scene several times. It is a single long cut, no repeated frames anywhere.
Wow.
Like that whole crowd was animated uniquely for, you know, it wasn't super long, but it was long enough that I could tell that scene looked really good. So just something like that, even like you just truly see the amount of effort put into this film, this feature length film, which just, you know, not to doom too much, but like I just feel like we don't see stuff like this anymore.
It's,
I will say that
it's different. Like there are things where you do see lots of really good detail and stuff, but it's not everything, certainly.
Yeah, there are a few spots where you can see corners being cut fairly obviously, as far as loops
for sure.
And...
like the water effects were, you know, they didn't have CGI to make the water look good, so they kind of did some interesting, you know, paint smearing, and you know, that's to me, that's still fine. I mean, trying to hand draw a typhoon and how people's clothing interacts in a typhoon, I can only imagine how difficult that is.
I mean, so. I will say that to give them credit, these guys are still kind of, the industry is still in this kind of trailblazing phase, right? They're still developing new techniques and figuring out how to do things. Like I think we talked about this before, like the transition from more of a commercial enterprise to more, it's still commercial, but driven by people who grew up on the stuff. So they're fans and they're kind of like trying to do new stuff. So like, like in the water things, right? You see them doing stuff that's, you know, probably a little bit original, right?
Experimentation. I would agree. I would agree there too. Yeah, I mean, I think that goes back to when we're, if you look at it now, you know, with the 25 years later lenses, like, you just see that the talent, the how talent dense Headgear is, right? Like from top to bottom, it's that
Yeah.
movie to this movie is, you know, is a to me it's a very special movie, like just from every element, not just technically, but you know, as far as pacing. The music, like, there's very, very little like Pat Labor movie one out there.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm a little late to this, but I had to refresh my memory on the computer virus stuff. It would have been actually pretty topical at the time this movie came out because, like, the Morris internet worm was in late 1988. You had a few other internet worms even later in 88 and one earlier in 87, not on internet, but on different networks that were around at the time. And you had a number of viruses that were cropping up from like 87 to 89 as well. So it would have been kind of one of those things that's cutting edge, but not totally speculative.
Right.
Which I think cutting edge, but not totally speculative. I think that kind of summarizes a lot of the kind of the technology stuff inside of the Pat Labor world, where you're like, okay, this would be like a cutting edge stuff, but you're like, it's still mostly in the world of today. And it was one of the things that Oishi said, and he wanted to do, and he spent a lot of time because actually doing location shoots inside of Tokyo. And basically they literally went out on boats and had a professional photographer do a bunch of location shoots. And it kind of really, this is the movie that established that Oishi style that you see that most people are most familiar with from Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah, like there were flashes of it in Beautiful Dreamer, and there's a callback to Beautiful Dreamer in this with that car headlight perspective shot that really reminded me of the one in Beautiful Dreamer. But yeah, it definitely goes harder on like the Oishi contemplative scenes. Like the investigation is kind of the Oishi contemplative scene for
Yeah,
me.
Matsui's investigation, that comes out like pretty much every time, I think, as I don't know where it still stands, but just in reading a whole bunch of the stuff written about it, basically like everyone at the time was like, oh my god, this investigation scene is like the most incredible thing we've seen in an anime like in a, such a long time, because it was one of these things where it turned it basically it took Hiromasa Ogura's backgrounds and it took them from this different perspective inside of Tokyo where stuff was animated but it was done from like taken from location shooting that they did inside of Tokyo from going on boats up what like the Sumida River and stuff like that, and taking that and turning just Kenji Kawai's incredible soundtrack
So good. Oh my God.
and the backgrounds into this complete character intense scene that has two characters that aren't even like main characters in the movie and no words. And you're just like, oh, you want to see what's incredible, like anime animation stuff? Here, watch this scene.
It's great
And
because it's been a long time since I've seen the other series, the TV and OVAs. But like, you have no idea watching this movie, if this is the first thing you're seeing, that who these guys are, and they're just doing
yeah.
this stuff. And then like, it comes together in the end, which I thought was just is so great. You see this stuff, I'm like, what are these guys doing? Oh, this is really interesting. It's kind of creepy. Like, it's very moody, very immersive. Like, and then it kind of, in most things, they probably would have just, you know, made this way more obvious about what's going on, and they would have, you know, had a bunch of dialogue explaining what they're doing. Like, but they just kind of let it sit there. I thought that was so good.
Yeah, it's you know, good storytelling at its best where it's entirely show don't tell.
Yeah.
The only, I
Where
think,
you
really
really
in this
don't
movie,
pick up stuff in advance of the characters.
yeah,
Yeah.
you're learning as they're kind of learning because they're going through and being like, all right, are these things connected? What is this? I don't know. It's just a bunch of crappy apartments. What the hell? What's the point of this? I think kind of the only real explanation part is kind of in the opening part of the movie where Asuma and Noah are on the helicopter riding out to the Ark. Mm-hmm. And the helicopter pilot gives kind of the, just, you know, it's not,
scene.
Yeah, it's not very long. And I think it's very helpful there, because otherwise you'd be like, all right, well, what is this? How do you get there?
Yeah.
And especially it's obvious that they did that, and then they pretty much didn't do that for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I thought that was done really well, too, in that it's just enough. It was very natural, right? It's like, hey, we're flying these SVU guys over, and we're just kind of like chatting, right? Like, and we're just explaining stuff. Maybe they know, maybe they don't, and they're not even paying attention, right? Like,
yeah, you want to sleep and be like,
yeah,
what?
Oh, yeah. And Noah's just giddy because she gets to see her new labor. So,
Okay, so sounds like everyone else is on board that this is a great movie. So good, I don't have to disown anyone. I don't know. Maybe I'm not the best person to know this one, because I just want to like go off in 80,000 different directions at every time. One of the other things that I think is interesting, with the whole Babel thing, and it's definitely, it's very Oshi Ito with the, and it's kind of one of those first things of using real actual like proper English for a translation, the Babel thing. And I think it's kind of interesting because the quote they give in the movie when they go to print stuff out is, or that's written on the wall, is the, go, let us go down and there confound their language that they may not understand one another's speech, from Genesis. But and actually, because this is printed in one of the books, there's actually a little bit more around that. There's two lines around that that kind of even fill it in more, which is kind of the more quote of from Genesis, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower where the children of men builded. Go, let us go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. Therefore is the name of it called Babel. So it's kind of like, it's, again, it's really interesting where they give you the middle of this line in the movie. They don't ever give you those extra two lines from that in the movie. But if you knew that, and I didn't, because I don't know all that stuff very well, you could kind of fill in, but I think certainly the audience wouldn't have known all that, certainly not in English.
Yeah, not the Japanese audience, yeah.
Certainly not the Japanese audience, and frankly, not even a lot of any English-speaking audience like would know all the stuff, you know, around that. But it's also, it's such an interesting one because it talks about that, but then it's literally, you know, like, oh, where the children have built this city and this tower, and it's, you know, you see Echihoba or Ehoba, who's putting a big brain on top of everyone there in this mystery. I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing to see the rest of the words around there.
It's also interesting that, you know, that connected with HOS itself, which is an operating system that apparently every labor can use, like, for all labors when it boots up. So, doesn't matter the brand, it can speak their language, apparently.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I picked up on that as well when watching it, and I was trying to think if there was any kinds of, like, is there some, like, Windows uptake at the time? Was it kind of a big issue or something? Because that was maybe, like, the first really big generic operating system. Well, I don't know if that played in at all.
Like,
no, Windows wouldn't have been much of a thing in 89 yet. It didn't really get serious uptake until about Windows 3.0, which I think was like...
So there was that segment in the movie where they're talking about like Bulba's background and how, you know, he was a savant at MIT, and Shinohara Heavy Industries was, you know, a latecomer in the labor manufacturing game, so in order to make up ground quickly, they decided to maybe tackle the software side more, and they scooped up Hoba, and he, you know, with Shinohara's resources, developed, you know, the HOS, and I guess it, you know, if I recall, for that scene they were talking about, it was such an upgrade that even, you know, rival companies opted into it because it was, you know, increased labor output, you know, by what, whatever, 30%. So, you know, that's, that sort of efficiency gain, you know, even if it's from a rival software, it's just something that they couldn't ignore. So that was like, you know, Shinohara's big foothold into dominating the market was kind of the context of that. So that, you know, explains why it was so, well, it was like 80% adoption or something. It was some gargantuan number, right?
Windows 3.0 didn't come out until May of 1990.
Okay.
And it was one of those things too where, like, I don't think, aside from a bunch of booming out boomer, bubblegum crisis boomer otakus like us, no one else was really aware of, like, operating system kind of until, like, Windows 95. That was the first time I think it was really kind of, like,
normies
advertised as a thing.
Literally, yeah. I was amused that Shinohara basically gave this critical component of their company's success, the HOS, to Hoba to basically do by himself this critical piece of software at a bus factor of one. And then the guy literally threw himself off a building. So nobody knew how it worked anymore.
I do want to kind of go off on a similar, like, on tangent, but not, but talking about Hoba and, you know, how the first scene you see is him hurling himself off the arc, right? Like, that's the very first cut of the movie. Mm-hmm. And the entire rest of the movie, he is the main antagonist, but he's dead.
Yeah, but
the
entire
time, everybody, that's all the stakeholders are doing their best to outsmart a dead man. And that, to, I didn't really realize to just the impact of that as far as, like, storytelling until, like, when I watched this movie. I think this is like the fifth or sixth time I watched it. I didn't really think about it from that angle for the longest time, but I just, how remarkable that they're able to make this character feel so menacing, so brilliant, so daunting, but he's been dead the entire movie. And everybody knows it, too. It's not like, you know, I mean, that's not true. At the very end, there's that kind of WTF moment. Yeah, but that's, even that suspense is kind of lifted within, what, a handful of minutes.
Well, so, and I will say, like, one of the things that, like, from watching so many movies is you kind of learn this trope of, if you don't see the body, they're not dead. And they even call out, right? Like, they never found the body. So they're kind of leaving this thing there of maybe he's not dead. Mm. And so it was nice that nice in a kind of dark way that he is basically dead. There's nothing, it's no more complicated than that. He died, right? The complication is in what he did before then, which I thought was also good.
Yeah, just in his, he was so, like, you know, he was so confident in his own hubris. He was like, I don't need to see this plan come to fruition because I know it'll work. And he, you know, sneers and jumps off the arc is, you know, kind of how I internalized it.
Yeah,
and in some ways, they're like, the end result is they're like, okay, well, we're screwed either way because either we're wrong and we destroy the arc, or we're right and we destroy the arc and we've already majorly crippled this project,
or, like, they're,
or
right,
they don't, yeah, or
and
we're,
they
right
don't, and they don't opt to destroy the arc, and the entire city of Tokyo is leveled.
Yeah,
which really brings Goto to the forefront for bringing that stuff up, and, like, what a masterful character he is.
A masterful manipulator he truly is.
Yes.
It's one of these things, where this movie, and I'm kind of curious of others, because I'm, like, others have watched more Palette of War, but haven't, or more than just this, but haven't, but, like, just watching this movie again for myself, I haven't watched TV in, it's been a, I don't know, a couple of years or something since I've watched TV or whatever, but just seeing how incredible the characters are in here, and just how developed and how much you understand them without even you don't get the introduction to Oda. He's just there, and you're like, well, I know exactly who this person is. Okay,
well, the introduction,
he's the bull in the China shop. Okay, got it.
His effective introduction is when he gets sent off and they're like, nobody You can tell he's a hothead, and nobody even wants to tell him that don't use your gun. He goes in, and the guy's like, "Oh, that labor, he just crushed my car. Go get him." He's like, "Oh, don't worry, I'll get him." And then he stomps the guy's car again, and he's like, "Oh, you jerk."
Yeah. It's like I think just like pretty much every character in the movie, like, you could watch the movie and be like, "Oh gosh, I don't know anybody's names, but I know who that character is."
Mm-hmm.
You know, other things that do that well is like Eva, where you're like, you know, all of the secondary characters, even if you don't remember their names right now, you're like, "Oh, I know what that person looks like, and I know how they act."
I will say too, I think that although Eva has really good characters, I think Pat Labor's characters are even better. I think so. They have a little bit more character to them, but mostly because they have more of a full life, whereas in Eva, it's a very single thing. But still very, very interesting characters. And like you say, you can understand them very, very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, Konoka's introduction in the movie is like that one scene in the airport where the border security person is like, are you here for pleasure? And she's like, "No, combat." And you're like, "Oh, I know what she's about. Here we go."
Yeah, like, she doesn't spend the next like decade in being interned at the border while they check her out either.
The border patrol also realizes they're like, "Yeah, you know what? We're just gonna let this one through." but yeah, exactly. You get that little introduction. Even if you never knew Konoka before, you're like, "Okay, I kind of understood she was someone who's important." She comes out, you're like, "Oh, okay, all right. She's a badass. All right, got it."
Mm-hmm.
What are people's feelings, continuing with the computer stuff, with the computer graphics that were done in the movie, and how do they look now?
Awful.
Yeah. Think so?
Well, okay. The arc visualization is not bad. I think that still kind of holds up. It shows age, but given the rest of the film, I think it fits. The other times that they had CG, like the I forget what it's called, like the Arc Project or something like that, they have a little intro thing they show on television, and it looks awful. Mm-hmm. It's got so much moire, and it's just like really, really like, we really wanted some 3D stuff on here, and we don't really care how bad it looks. But I think that was pretty much all I can remember. So like, anything else was okay.
I mean, I was thinking of the OS startup logo.
Oh, that was pretty good. I felt like it was a little bit too dirty, I guess, is one way to say it. Like, I think if it was real, it would be a little bit cleaner. Not necessarily like anti-aliased or anything, but I think that one is pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'd buy that as a 1999 startup sequence, but certainly it's plausible up through about the mid 90s in real tech.
Well, because
but it's one of those.
It's just lines. So like, I think you could do it back then, right? Pretty simple.
Well, so was it established that the Haas was only for labors, or was it for like all computer systems? Did they ever disclose that in the movie? I don't recall.
I'm pretty sure it's just for labors.
Okay, so if that's the case, since labors are considered like heavy machinery, even now when you think about it, like heavy machinery usually doesn't have really nice shiny graphics. It's pretty utilitarian, pretty gritty. So I feel it's in theme with the fact that labors are meant to be heavy machinery, not like consumer grade machinery. So I feel like in that sense, it's probably aligned. Like if you think about it, the Ark is probably comparable to like a modern day oil rig, like in the, you know, middle of whatever ocean. And, you know, I'm no expert, but from the handful of like YouTube videos that have done like History Channel stuff that's done like tours of it, like the hardware on those, you know, it's meant to be more robust than like shiny. So I don't know. I feel like it's in line with the theme that, you know, it is heavy machinery first, not, you know, and looks and other things are kind of a secondary thing.
And aside from that, just the practicality of it being made in 1988, 89, when it was when they actually did the computer graphic stuff. Mm-hmm. But like it was literally done then, kind of. But yeah, definitely is one of those things you could see it as a reasonable startup logo for you'd be like, oh yeah, if I saw that startup logo in up kind of almost up till Windows 95, because their whole thing was being shiny about that, you'd be like, oh, this is a pretty nice startup logo.
Mm-hmm.
I think I agree with some of the other stuff, but I still feel like the CGI, while it doesn't look great now, I feel like it also at least, like, it was had a consistent look throughout the movie, such that it kind of, even now looking back at it, you're like, yeah, it looks weird, but it also kind of looks like, oh, okay, it's kind of like, you know, it's better than, you know, watching Independence Day or something like that, where, you know, any of those mid-90s flame CGI stuff where you're like, oh yeah, gosh, this hurts to watch now.
Uh-huh.
How I would put it for me is that it visibly ties the movie to a specific date when it was produced, but it's not immersion breaking in
I agree
way.
Yeah. Even the worst of it, right, like is just kind of like, although I still think they could have done without that other stuff is a bit gratuitous, but it's not immersion breaking because it's not important to anything.
Yeah, and maybe in this alternate technical timeline, you know, all of the effort that was spent on better computer graphics in our world got spent on the robot tech for the labors instead.
Yeah.
Seems like a lot went into that. We're not out of time, but we don't have all the time in the episode left, and this could go on forever, but we're not going to. So we'll come back around to stuff. I want to talk about the soundtrack and sound design in this movie, because it's so incredible. And the soundtrack, it's one of those things where you hear the music and you see the movie, or you see the movie and you can't separate them out. I think I'm trying to think of another, like some of the other Oshii and Kenji Kawai stuff has the same feel. This definitely was the first one. I'm trying to think of stuff that's not that has that feel.
I mean, for I think what it's I would worth, this is the, I think this might be the first time that I noticed not only the soundtrack, but the composer, like, of a thing. Mm-hmm. It was so striking to me that I kind of sought it out. I was like, oh, Kenji Kawai. And that name stuck. I think before even Yoko Kanno, like, I was like, oh, Kenji Kawai. This is Pat Labor. The music is so good. Especially the investigation stuff is just so good.
Yeah, I was trying to, the other one that I could think of that's unrelated to this, that is like so stunning. I agree with the name that you're like, oh, who did this? But I think like the Akira soundtrack.
Oh yeah, true.
Because it's so wild and stunning, and it just so fits in exactly with it. It's that same level of just complete immersion between the sound enhancing the film and the film enhancing the sound, and then all of the sound effects are done so incredibly well too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, down to the level in the opening scene where the you know, the Oshii's a well-known military nut, you know, but down to the level of detail of the paratrooping in labors, and that they have the retro jets that fire before they hit the ground. It's just such this incredible level of little detail that is the thing. I think that sort of thing is what makes the Pat Labor movie so great, is just the little details in everything, like that, to the level of, oh yeah, well, of course you need to have a little retro thruster to fire, otherwise the labor is going to fall and hit the ground and break their actuators. Okay.
Oh, and when the labors are coming out of the back of the planes, and they got that cable coiled that's uncoiling as it goes out the back, that just is so striking to me too.
Yeah, I think it's, I'm trying to think, like, it's a hard movie to break down into its component elements, because I think if you looked at each of them, like, if you kind of broke down the plot on its own, you'd be like, oh, that's pretty simple. Or you broke down even, like, the character stuff, where this really was meant to be like Noah and Asuma as a, you know, a good character vehicle for them, and putting most of the other characters in the background. Like, you hardly see, you know, like Hiromi or any of the other members of SV2 or anything. Goto's in there a bit, but he's almost in there as the he's not an antagonist, but he's kind of like an anti-protagonist or something almost. He's kind of a foil, but almost not.
Asuma's antagonist the whole
movie. Yeah. Yeah, it's so interesting in that he's kind of guiding him along, but also being like, yeah, well, you know, I wanted you to do the work to verify it. I had my hunch, but now we actually know. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Even Noah, the movie, feels a little light on, honestly. It's very much Asuma's movie.
Very mm-hmm. much agreed, yeah. Like, even though Noah is widely considered the main character of Pat Labor, this movie, I think, was majority Asuma. But at the same time, they repeat this line a few times, right? Where the forward and the backup are as one or something like that. Like, that phrase is repeated. So, you know, it's obvious that neither can do their job to the fullest without the other. So they always, you know, even when that scene, you know, a critical scene too, where Asuma kind of, you know, yanks Noah out to that pizza parlor, and there's that like awkward silence when they're sitting in front of the pie. It's like painfully awkward, right?
Uh-huh.
And you're wondering like, what is going on here? And then finally, Asuma asks like, "You overheard the conversation, didn't you?" And she breaks down. You're like, "Aha, okay, so this is why he dragged her out here." So, you know, but such a brilliant scene, right? Like, it really shows like the depth of their partnership at a professional level, because they don't want to cheap. I feel like it would cheapen it if they turned it into some sort of weird romantic thing, right?
I mean, but so. It kind of is. The tension between them is part of it, right? Like, if they resolved it, it wouldn't be the same.
True, but it's. I also appreciate that they don't go heavy with it. They just let it play out as is without, like, being overt, which totally. I appreciated a lot.
And just, like, on the Noah thing, like, it actually was a very intentional thing on Masami Yuki's part that he wanted to have the main character be Noah and be a woman who was part of the police and was doing the stuff. You know, I think particularly coming out of where the original kind of ideas came around, like, for Pat Labor, out of, like, call it roughly 1985 in Japan, which was not a very progressive place for for women in a corporate workforce environment.
Definitely not. Yeah, I mean, you can argue that's still the case. So
yeah, and to have her be... I think that's one of the lasting things that makes Pat Labor so great, is that you have all these characters from different stuff, and like, it's such a well done ideal thing of this. Well, yeah, she's a really good police officer doing her job. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah, well, yeah, well, she's a woman and she's doing it, but it's kind of like it's disarming.
It doesn't feel forced right. at all. It doesn't feel like it's based on some sort of a gender or whatever other lens people might put on it. It's just, that's how it is. And what I find remarkable is it's not just Noah. There's also, you know, Kanuka, who is quite possibly the most, you know, talented Labor pilot in the, you know, the character roster that we see in Pat Labor. And then you also see Shinobu, who you don't even really see how talented she is, but just the fact that she is the only individual that Goto is 100% transparent with his conversations. She goes a long way, because you'd see that Goto is playing the mastermind this whole movie, but she is his confidant the entire time. Like, he is talking to her. I didn't record it, but I think the number of minutes of the movie that is just Goto and Shinobu talking is like a huge amount of the movie, actually. Mm-hmm.
I think it's more than it feels like, it should be. But yeah, and like, she's every bit at least as smart as he is, probably more. There's more than that in a lot of the other productions and stuff. She's such an incredible character.
And something that isn't kind of really emphasized is that she is the captain of SV1, which is considered to be the A team, right?
Yeah.
A squad, whereas SV2 are kind of the bad news bears. Oh gosh, I don't know if that reference is going to go through with our audience, but are the, you know, B squad, the JV, if you will, the rough riders, the roughnecks of, you know, the mobile police. But, you know, they're plucky and they have heart, right? So that's why everybody loves them.
Right.
Well, except for people that get called on them, because even in the movie there, where the I think the guy's riding in the battle board that's gone wild, and they're like, "Oh, they got here, police!" It's like, "Oh, thank goodness!" He's like, "It's SV2." He's like,
"Oh what? No, everybody oh, run!"
No, I'm dead.
largely
which is,
because
again,
of Ota. Let's be real.
Which is again just kind of a hilarious, like, little piece of detail that I think makes it such that you could, like, yes, if you knew the characters more, would you get more out of it? Yes. But it also makes it such that you're like, okay, all right, I kind of see who this team is. All right, gotcha. One of the other things that I saw early in my anime viewing thing where I had a similar thing was the first Lupin the Third thing I ever saw was Castle of Cagliostro.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I'm thinking of that here, because, again, it's a roster of characters that most people watching it at the time would have known the characters. But when, you know, my friends and I, we started watching that movie in high school, like, we randomly found it and we're like, well, this is incredible. We didn't even know for quite a while there was other movies and productions and stuff that were Lupin the Third. And we're just like, who are these people? And then all of a sudden you got the... you got Goemon showing up, and you're like, oh man, well, who's that guy? Well, clearly he's a badass samurai. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. So I think it does the same level of just good immersive character storytelling where you can just kind of be like, well, yeah, if I knew more about these characters, it might be like, oh, that's cool, I get to see this. But even without it, it's done so well that it stands alone, which is really hard considering how many characters are involved in the Pat Labor movie and the complexity of the plot as well, and everything sticks together.
You know, it occurs to me that I feel the same way about Pat Labor as I do Eva, which is that it's a very rich world that's kind of stuck with the original creators, but I feel like they should be released from them, not forcibly taken away, but I would love to see more Pat Labor, an extended universe kind of thing, much like I would like to see for Eva. There's just not enough of it, and there should be more, because it's a rich mine of content. So please.
And I feel like there's been a few things. There was a couple years ago, I don't know how much it was done, there was like a live action thing that was done.
Yeah,
I know. I didn't watch it either. I felt I would just be sad, so I didn't watch it.
Exactly. Same.
All right. So we are wrapping up here because we've gone to time. So I'll let everyone kind of give a favorite scene or something that you think is just something good, which is, you know, really hard in this movie to find. I'll start, and I'm going to take the diner scene with Noah and Asuma. I think it's such a fabulously well-done character thing, where, again, is so little dialogue, and it's, again, it's just everything about it is executed so well, including the motorcycle ride over there, and everyone getting jealous that Asuma says he's going to take Noah on a date, and everyone hates him, and then it's not really a date, and he ditches her at the end.
Yeah, a really great date.
Yeah, the whole scene is, it's fabulous. That's my pick for something. I'll pass it on to, I'll go in introduction order, except I skipped there. I'll pass it on to Mike.
Yeah, for me, one of the great examples of show not tell in this movie is the scene with where they figure out the resonance with Noah and the tea kettle. And it just starts the glass of the display cabinet shaking from its whistle.
By the time they explain it,
you've already picked up on it.
And talk about brilliance in sound design. It's perfect there. Like, you see that and you're like, oh, that's, you forget, it's so well done that you forget it's animated and people had to construct this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, of course it makes that sound. Yeah, that's another great scene there. All right, go with Nick.
I'll go with a bit of a different angle than the others. So I think we've gone over just how talent rich the staff behind Pat Labor is. But to go even deeper, one of the ittiest, bittiest, tiniest bit roles in the whole movie, which was the weather broadcaster
in that scene,
none other than a young, plucky Megumi Hayashibara.
Oh, really?
I heard it too.
One of her earliest roles in I would say, major, major thing. But right around when she started to really take off, obviously, because, you know, Ranma One Half was not too far from Pat Labor. But
and she does have a different, she's a different character, but it's the same role. She has a recurring role in Pat Labor TV as a news reporter.
Right.
Yeah. Which is also great.
But TV, I believe, is aired, a year or two after this movie?
So, yeah, it was like 90-something, but yeah. Yeah,
90-2, I think, or something, or somewhere thereabouts. But yeah, I thought that was interesting, and obviously, yeah, can't say enough about this movie. Pat Labor, last thing I'll say is, real robots as a concept in anime cannot exist without Pat Labor. Pat Labor is a foundational property in real mech. I think, you know, anybody who talks about Gundam also has to talk about Pat Labor, because... you know, it's foundational in how it establishes just how you can normally integrate, you know, mechs into, like, contemporary society. Nothing does it better than Pat Labor, in my opinion, period.
Yeah.
So, agreed. Yeah, those are my closing statements.
All right, Sam?
I don't know if I can think of a favorite scene, but I will say just about everything Goto. He's my favorite character in Pat Labor. I just love how he's kind of plays stupid, but he's actually smart and is manipulating everybody to do what he wants.
I thought
that was really good.
He's brilliant.
I do want to say that I like the thing about this movie that I really like is how, I think you mentioned this, something like this a little earlier, that the story itself is very simple. And I think they kind of solve the whole thing very early on, but there's this, the unfolding nature of everything of like, oh, you think it's over, but really, oh, now we have to figure out this other thing. We have to deal with this thing. Oh, okay. Now we have to do this. Like, it keeps it going at a really nice pace. You're never sitting there like you never really know what's going to happen next, and it's never really feels slow at any point. It's always has you kind of guessing about what's going on. I think that's one of the great things about this movie.
Yeah, it's the whodunit where we know whodunit.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, how do we logistically work our way out of this or figure out what is actually going on?
It's less a whodunit and more a what the heck is it and how do we stop it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which it just makes it so great. And then the other thing here is that we learn about, I don't know, do we learn about the importance of password security? And not having the password be a.hoba?
Yeah. That was probably
At the same time, I'm also like, well, he kind of wanted people to find out about it even more anyways.
True.
Like, did he intentionally use poor password security?
Right, more of the taunting.
Yeah, I feel like it was more taunting.
When he used that password, didn't it then, like, catch the... Or, I'm trying to think, was that for the host disk? That's true,
Didn't it set off the computers or something?
Yep, it set off all the computers at the manufacturing, at the Shinohara thing. Where also we get a very scene that I feel like Anno definitely saw and liked, which is where we get the computer screens turning from blue to red, like there.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Which was very, I was like, oh man. It's like, that's such a iconic Eva scene of stuff doing that, like when the with the Magi and everything. But I was like, oh man, it's like almost the same shade of blue and red. All right, yeah. We've gone well over our allotted time for Pat Labor, but that's okay. I'm sure we'll be back to this well at some point.
Oh, yes.
We do have a correction of last time from Mike on Abinobashi.
Well, less of a correction and more just a note from valued listener and friend of the podcast, Nick Goose, who mentions about Kenji Tsuruta, the character designer, and artist of one of the two Abinobashi manga, because strangely it got two, who says that he's having an odd bit of relevance right now. Last year, Dark Horse completed the translation to Emanon, and on top of that, a new Blu-ray for the adapted Spirit of Wonder OVAs just dropped in Japan, complete with English subtitles. Kenny Lauderdale made a video about the dub for the series, which helped raise awareness of the work among fans. Mm. And Helen McCarthy retweeted video for the new Blu-ray release, which came out, it looks like, back in March, and supposedly looks pretty good. You can find that on the YouTube Emotion Label channel. The title is Spirit of Wonder Blu-ray Box PV.
Okay, nice.
So thank you for that, Nick Goose.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's always good to learn something new about something cool. Next time, we will be doing a potpourri episode, probably doing some Fanime wrap-up, maybe talking Baki Monogatari intro, kind of a first four eps, possibly getting through spring, winter shows, maybe even talking about Juni Taisen or Zodiac War, because I watched all of that on a recommend that I absolutely don't watch that.
I warned you.
So, thanks for listening, and until next time, this is AMO Kenzoku saying Saraba.